Something we'll be considering to a large extent in the coming chapters, including this one, is the concept of cooperation. In cooperation, what we have is more than one entity helping out each other. This can result in an increase in, for example, the functionality or the fitness of the entity that's being helped. It can also result in a decline in the fitness or functionality of the entity that's doing the helping. Generally, we see cooperation evolving within systems in which there's some kind of reproductive linkage between the individuals that in fact are cooperating. In this way, by giving to another, one can potentially enhance one's own reproductive success. And whenever that's the case, there is a reasonable probability that in fact cooperation can be stably maintained within a system. Going even further, we can look at our own bodies. Our own bodies consist of populations of cooperating cells. Most of these cells do not contribute to the next generation. Only the germline in our cells do that. However, by cooperating among themselves, they can increase the likelihood that, in fact, the body as a whole will successfully reproduce, since all of the cells within our body, more or less, possess the same genotype. As a consequence, by increasing the potential for the reproductive cells, the germline, to reproduce, we in fact are increasing, or our individual cells are increasing, their own likelihood that their genotype will be passed on to the next generation. Here in this chapter, we'll be focusing particularly on the evolution of cooperation within populations of microorganisms. In subsequent chapters, we'll be talking about variations on this theme, including in terms of the evolution of symbioses, the evolution of virulence, which has a surprising amount of cooperation involved in it, and also in terms of the evolution of greater size and complexity. Generally, what we have is a cooperative interaction in which there is an increase in fitness, but also potentially the converse, where there is a decrease in fitness, which we would describe as a defection, or instead as cheating. So in this chapter, what we'll be considering is in fact cooperation. Our next step is to consider the evolution of cooperation in microbial systems using specific examples that will illustrate what we're considering, the ideas that when you have essentially clonal populations and you have a situation where mutual cooperation indeed is potentially helpful, or where restraint is helpful so as to avoid the tragedy of the commons, and where cheating can be avoided by either having the inability of cheaters to invade a population from the outside or perhaps from the inside, then you can have some potential to, in fact, have an evolution of cooperative systems among microbes. And a good example of this is what can be seen, or at least inferred, from what's going on within bacterial biofilms. So biofilms are typically unrelated assemblages of often metabolically cooperative bacteria. So this metabolic cooperation is actually typically going on between species making up a biofilm rather than within a given species. And that would be an example of interspecific cooperation. That's actually not what we're referring to in this case, but instead intraspecific cooperation, cooperation within a population rather than between populations. And biofilms provide good examples of the potential for intraspecific cooperation as well, or at least according to Kreft in his 2004 paper that we've referred to a couple of times already. So he writes, individual-based model simulations show that spatial structure, as in, for example, biofilms, is necessary for the origin and maintenance of cooperation. He describes it as a primitive altruistic strategy, but basically it's cooperation at its most basic level. It's the absence of spatial structure, that is, a well-mixed environment, that otherwise gives rise to the common belief that growth rate, but not necessarily growth yield, decides the outcome of competition. And this is based upon chemistat models and experiments, as well as batch culture models. So when people basically are doing microbiology using broth cultures, typically what's most important to these organisms in an evolutionary sense in these broth cultures is how fast they can grow. And in biofilms, those kinds of strategies don't necessarily get you as far. And it's particularly the restraint from growing as fast as one possibly can that is the basic cooperative strategy that one sees within biofilms. And this again is a mechanism that is interfering with the result of a tragedy of the commons. So there's less of a tragedy if, in fact, if growth is not emphasized over, for example, yield or more generally, long-term fitness. So this evolutionary perspective on life in biofilms can explain long-known biofilm characteristics, such as the structural organization into microcolonies. So these microcolonies, they're initiated to a large extent from just a single cell, or at least that seems to be the case. And you have growth of, therefore, of these clonally related, spatially associated bacteria, and there's potential for evolution of cooperation among those bacteria, whereas if they're just well-mixed bacteria making up a larger, essentially broth population, there's potential for evolution of cooperation would be much less. So the often observed lack of mixing among microcolonies, so these microcolonies stay clonal, there's not this invasion of cheaters from without, and the shedding of single cells as promoting the origin maintenance of altruistic strategies. As we'll get to, the shedding of single cells is essentially gives rise to a bottlenecking, which can have the effect of increasing the likelihood that assemblages of cells, in fact, are clonally related. Whereas biofilms enrich altruists, broth enrichment cultures, microbiology's paradigm for isolating bacteria into pure culture, select instead for high growth rates. So what Kreft is making the argument is that if you in fact can have spatial structure and can have this clonal structure to populations, then you can have the evolution of especially restraint in terms of growth rates, so that rather than emphasizing growth in terms of the fastest growth possible by a population, instead what can be emphasized is the ultimate yield of that population. This is another way of saying that the population is emphasizing carrying capacity, or K, rather than growth rate, or R. It's a more long-term perspective, and it takes some restraint in terms of the members of the population. And these ideas of restraint will show up again more generally when we talk about growth rate versus growth yield in another system, as it happens a system that is in broth culture rather than a biofilm. But starting with biofilms. So this is a simulation, or at least a illustration of a simulation of the growth of a biofilm. And what you have here are two types of bacteria. One type grows faster, at least initially, and the other type grows more slowly, at least initially. The faster growing type, therefore, produces more cells in the short term. These are cells that are not displaying a restraint in terms of their growth. These are the cells that potentially are leading down the road to a tragedy of the commons, whereas these other cells over here on the left are emphasizing restraint, and as a consequence, their growth rate is lesser, but ideally, at least for them, their growth yield is going to be enhanced as a consequence of this restraint in their growth rate. But at this point, the growth yield is not enhanced. Instead, what you see is essentially more cells by the bacteria that are not restraining their growth, simply because early on, faster growth is giving rise to more cells, but that could change. So this is a biofilm microcolony that has been founded by a single bacterium. In this case, it's a single bacterium that is not displaying restraint in its growth. So it's essentially maximizing its growth rate. And this is how biofilms disperse. There's some degree of fragmentation. There is a resulting in liberation of, in fact, individual cells, single cells, and these single cells can go on and form a new biofilm. So you can have selection for cooperative high yields rather than high rates of growth if the rate, frequency, or degree of fragmentation, so the rate of fragmentation, the frequency of fragmentation, or the extent of fragmentation, and this would be fragmentation here, resulting in basically individual cells, is not a function of bacterial growth rate. In other words, if it, what's important here is rates of transmission, essentially, or the rate of establishment of new microcolonies. And that rate is going to be dependent upon the rate, frequency, or degree of fragmentation of these existing microcolonies. And if the amount of fragmentation, if the amount of transmission, if the amount of establishment of new microcolonies from old microcolonies is not a function of bacterial growth rate, then you can instead have selection for increases in, for example, bacterial growth yield. That is number of cells that are ultimately produced, if that gives rise to enhanced amounts of dispersal or transmission of these microcolonies. So if growing fast does not lead ultimately in a single microcolony producing lots of new progeny microcolonies, then growing fast may not be selected for. Alternatively, if growing more slowly but ultimately producing more bacteria, that is having a higher growth yield, does result in the production of new microcolonies, then you will have selection potentially for this higher growth yield rather than higher growth rate. In the short term, though, if in fact you have sampling of the microcolonies so that you in fact have fragmentation going on early on, so that high growth rate is more important than high growth yield, you'll see opposite results. So these fragments are considered to be broken up into individual cells that then disperse to found new microcolonies. And these are these individual cells here. So these individual cells, they find their way to new surfaces and they establish new microcolonies. And what we're seeing here is early growth of the microcolony, so only a couple weeks into its formation. And what we have here is dominance of this biofilm by cells that in fact are not displaying restraint in their growth. So they're the cells, the blue cells, that are displaying an early growth rate advantage. So if fragmentation occurred at this point in time, there'd be more blue cells, and so there'd be an advantage to having this higher early on growth rate, because ultimately, if each of these cells is able to found a new microcolony, then there would be more microcolonies produced by the blue cells than by the red cells. The blue cells have a growth rate advantage over the red cells. So early 3-week growth rate disadvantage displayed by the red cells, but this doesn't matter if fragmentation does not occur early. Only if fragmentation occurs early while the blue cells still have an advantage, will there be an advantage in terms of dispersal or transmission that comes from having an early growth advantage. So alternatively, later in the biofilm growth, yield advantage does matter if in fact it is later in the growth of the biofilm that fragmentation occurs. So what we have here are cells, blue cells, that are displaying an early growth rate advantage, but recall antagonistic pleiotropy. This early growth rate advantage is associated with a later in the maturation of the biofilm growth rate disadvantage. And so now the red cells are more numerous than the blue cells. So the red cells have taken longer to become more numerous. They have a growth rate disadvantage, but that growth rate disadvantage presumably is coming about as a consequence of them doing something that allows them, as the biofilm matures, to display a growth rate advantage. And we'll get to what kinds of things they might be doing that will give rise to that growth rate advantage later on, and therefore a growth yield advantage later on. But for now, it's simply an idea of an antagonistic pleiotropy. The blue cells have an advantage early on, but it comes at the expense of their ability to compete later on in this later growth stage. Instead, the red cells have a disadvantage early on, but it comes with the advantage, or as a consequence, of the potential to display higher competitive ability later on, and therefore the yield later on of the red cells is much higher than the fraction of red cells that you see early on. And this is because they're growing more slowly, but in a sense, they're growing better so that ultimately they can produce more cells. So if you have fragmentation going on here, you're going to get a lot of red cells. So if you're competing these red cells and blue cells in the same biofilm, ultimately the red cells are going to make more progeny if you wait for a longer time until the biofilm is mature before you release these red cells. So before you release all the cells, there's going to be more cells that are red cells, and therefore the growth yield is going to give the red cells an advantage. In order to have that growth yield advantage, they have to display restraint in their growth early on, which is a cooperative behavior. So here, defection is higher growth rates early on, and cooperation gives rise to, not displaying those higher growth rates early on can give rise to these growth yield advantages later on, which translate into more cells being released at the point of dissemination, which in turn translates into more cells able to found new microcolonies, and therefore the community becoming more dominated by the red cell cooperators rather than the blue cell defectors. So getting to bottlenecks, so the bottleneck is occurring because we have single cells that are initiating these microcolonies. So these single cells essentially are able to establish microcolonies where all the cells in those microcolonies are clonally related. You can see this best with these red, essentially they're called mushrooms or microcolonies that are seen here, where the microcolonies were established with a single cell. And therefore, these microcolonies are clonally related to one another. So, as a consequence, if they are displaying cooperation within the microcolony, they can display an advantage, a fitness advantage, as a consequence of that cooperative behavior that impacts particularly the red cells, the cooperating genotype, rather than other cells such as the blue genotype. Now, this cooperative behavior that they're displaying, now we haven't really talked about what it is, but it is presumably coming at the expense of these red cells' ability to display a growth rate advantage early on. And therefore, the blue cells display a growth rate advantage early on. That's the advantage of defecting. But later on, the red cells are displaying an advantage because whatever has been sacrificed to having a high growth rate advantage early on is allowing these cells to display a higher yield later on with maturity of the biofilm. Therefore, they produce more of these cells. And then it's the fragmentation of these cells that allows for this bottleneck, that allows for the clonal populations to be associated with one another, and therefore cooperators to be associated with cooperators and defectors with defectors, which in turn leads with fragmentation occurring later on in the maturation of these biofilms to an advantage, a yield advantage by the cooperators, which then translates into more microcolonies associated with the cooperators in the next generation. So this is a scenario for the evolution of cooperation within biofilms. So this is spatial structure. There's not a whole lot of mixing going on here. And because there's not a whole lot of mixing going on here, cooperators can stay physically associated with cooperators and defectors physically associated with defectors. That causes the defectors to, in fact, ultimately be at a disadvantage because they're not able to take advantage of whatever cooperative behavior the cooperators, the red cells, are displaying because they're not invading into red cell populations. So this is a sampling following culture maturation. Key to this model is that you are not getting release of cells until the culture, until the biofilm in fact matures. But why would a biofilm do that? Why not just sit down, make lots of cells as fast as possible, and then release them? Well, the answer is that there can be trade-offs between the production of new cells and the release of those new cells. And another thing that's going on here is that surfaces are limiting within environments, that it's not that easy for a cell to find a surface. And so cells are not going to necessarily quickly find surfaces. And an advantage may be associated not so much with quickly producing cells that can then look for surfaces that are not yet covered with bacteria, but instead to produce as many cells as you possibly can so that you're releasing lots and lots of cells, and those cells then can find their way to new surfaces to establish new microcolonies. Now, these late maturing microcolonies, the red microcolonies that are displaying this growth yield advantage, are essentially maximizing the amount of cells that ultimately they're going to be releasing. And the strategy may be one where essentially the more cells you release, the greater the likelihood that you'll be able to find an open niche where those cells can themselves form a new microcolony. Whereas a disadvantage is associated with making progeny too quickly because you're not producing enough of those progeny ultimately, and therefore the potential to find these open niches, these places to establish new microcolonies, may be slight. So in situations where there's limitations and you need to have a substantial competitive ability, you can often see more cooperative behavior or at least greater restraint on growth, where instead of maximizing growth rates, the individual species are instead putting more emphasis on maximizing competitive ability, which is what you're seeing here. And that's a classic K versus R strategy argument, where you have R species, R selected organisms that are maximizing growth rate. And they do this particularly because the environment is not very limiting in the ability of whatever progeny they produce to find new locations to establish themselves. Whereas the K-selected individuals instead are in environments where there's a great deal of competition and it's very difficult for progeny to become established. So therefore, you need to do something to increase the likelihood that the progeny will become established. And this often involves something other than simply maximizing the growth rate of those progeny, or maximizing the reproductive rate of the individuals that are already established. So it is a bit of a contradiction here that, in fact, it is the individuals that are showing restraint that ultimately are producing the most progeny. But this is kind of like what you see with, for example, an oak tree. So an oak tree, you know, it takes a long time for that oak tree to mature, and the oak tree is going to be there for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the bigger that oak tree is, even though it takes a long time for it to become big, the more progeny, the more acorns that oak is going to produce. And in a steady state where essentially each oak tree on average is reproducing itself and making one progeny that goes on to survive, the more progeny you can produce over longer periods of time, the more likely that a surviving oak tree is going to be your offspring. And it's the same thing that's going on here, although with these microcolonies. It is not growing as fast as you possibly can, like a weed and then making seeds, that is necessarily going to allow these microcolonies to establish new microcolonies in the next generation. But instead, like an oak tree, it's taking your time establishing yourself and being able to make a huge number of progeny, disseminating progeny, which are acorns for the oak, or individual cells for the microcolony that actually provides the greater competitive ability. But there's more to it than just that. So this is selection for cooperators because ultimately they're making more cells, which may be able to found new microcolonies. So perhaps the number of cells released can be greater given longer maturation. So the idea here is that the longer the microcolony can remain established, the longer it can outcompete its neighbors, and perhaps the bigger it can become, like that big oak tree, then ultimately the more cells it has the potential to disseminate. And if more cells disseminated translates into a higher fitness, that is a higher likelihood of passing progeny on to the next generation, then there should be selection for these microcolonies that are longer lasting, that grow to larger sizes, that are perhaps more competitive against neighboring microcolonies, and therefore are able to establish themselves like the oak tree and make lots of seeds, in this case, lots of disseminating cells. But there's more to it than that. So perhaps release of these cells conflicts with growth, as we indicated, with biases towards growth equivalent to the marginal value theorem of optimal foraging theory. That is, exploit where you are while the exploiting is good versus risking dissemination into environments unknown. So if you've got lots of niche, lots of empty environment out there to fill up, then you don't necessarily have to establish yourself in one location and stay in that location for as long as you possibly can to make as many offspring as you possibly can. In the case of biofilms, the environment that they have invaded is, of course, a surface, and the advantage of a surface is that nutrients flow past surfaces as currents flow past these surfaces. And these nutrients are the cells that are on the surfaces are able to gather up these nutrients. And so by establishing yourself in one position, you found essentially fertile ground, like an oak tree has found fertile ground. And you want to exploit that for as long as you possibly can. In fact, the marginal value theorem says that you should exploit that until you reach the point where essentially the number of progeny that you are going to be able to produce, which will then leave that location, is sufficient so that your progeny can find new locations at a rate that allows them to essentially continue the growth rate seen in the original location at the same rate, at the same to the same degree. So the oak tree wants to basically grow and grow and grow as much as it can in its new location until it's big enough to start producing acorns that might establish oak trees that are able to grow, grow, grow in new locations, such that even given the lag until new oak trees are producing their acorns, the rate of population growth remains the same. And so the idea here is that you found a nice place to live, you've got access to resources, your progeny aren't likely to have access to resources because they're going to find it difficult to find a new surface to inhabit. You've already found your surface, so you stick with it, but there's probably a conflict between the rate at which you can grow and the rate at which you can disseminate. This is an antagonistic pleiotropy, and indeed, just disseminating removes the number of cells that are present that are able to grow and therefore able to compete. And so you stick around and in your location that you found where you're getting nutrients, and you basically build up your size until you have lots of cells that then can be released. And you release those cells optimally at the point where the lag in the new cells finding a new location and then establishing themselves as sufficiently mature microcolonies before they disseminate is not so great that they can't themselves make progeny at a rate that's potentially, well, that is as fast as the potential to make progeny once you've already matured to a large extent. So those ideas of marginal value are, I'm sure I didn't state them all that well. What you have is a population that basically, in the traditional sense, sticks around in a patch until the amount of resources in that patch is sufficiently reduced that it pays to move to a new patch or try to move to a new patch, even though there are time costs and risks associated with moving from one patch to another patch. If you are trying to eat out of your emptying cupboard in your kitchen and refrigerator in your kitchen, and you've depleted the amount of food, but you know it's a real pain to go shopping, you're going to keep eating away at that food until the quality of the food or the amount of food that's left in your kitchen, in your cupboard, in your refrigerator is sufficiently low that you're willing to invest the time and energy to go out and to go shopping and buy new food. I mean, this is essentially the marginal value theorem. As applied to these biofilms, you stick around until the ability to continue pr to produce new cells that then can go on to ultimately found new microcolonies is diminished sufficiently that it is time to essentially release those cells and let the progeny cells go on to find the new environments to get themselves established and go on. There's diminishing returns, in other words, for sticking around forever before you reproduce. And even for K-selected organisms, ultimately they're going to have to reproduce. They can't have an infinite generation time. And so the point at which reproduction occurs essentially is the point at which you are maximizing the number of progeny that you can possibly produce that have the potential to move on and establish themselves and produce progeny of their own. So with biofilms, the fastest growing and fastest disseminating individuals are not necessarily maximizing over the long term the amount of progeny they're producing, but instead it is the slower growing individuals that are producing more individuals over long time frames, simply because they're outcompeting other individuals within the biofilm itself, other microcolonies, producing big microcolonies that then can re release lots of disseminating cells. So, what is it about these microcolonies that may be causing a trade-off between growth rate and growth yield? And this paper by Xavier and Foster, which I just love, basically argues that the trade-off is in terms of the production of EPS, that is extracellular polymeric substances. So this is the glue that holds together the microcolonies. If you're going to have a big microcolony, you have to have good glue, and therefore those microcolonies that invest more in producing this extracellular polymeric substance have the potential to become larger and therefore ultimately produce more cells, which then go on to ultimately produce potentially or at least more microcolonies or establish more microcolonies. But producing EPS is costly, and as a consequence, it can come at a growth rate disadvantage. So here we have a mechanistic explanation for how you can have this trade-off between growth rate and growth yield. You're making lots of EPS and it slows you down, but ultimately it allows you to make a larger microcolony, which has more cells that ultimately will disseminate. So this is the same idea again as the oak tree versus the weeds. The oak tree is investing a huge amount of energy into its wood, into its trunk, into its height. And this energy is coming in the oak tree at the cost of its ability to grow fast. I mean, oak trees are awesome trees, but it takes time for those trees to grow up. And so that is a growth rate disadvantage, but when they do grow up, they can make a huge number of acorns. That's a growth yield advantage. And the same idea is going on with the microcolonies. They're slower in their establishment, but it gives them a greater potential to compete, a greater potential to gather resources in the nutrients that are flowing past the microcolonies, and ultimately an ability to produce more cells per microcolony that then can move on to disseminate and ideally found new microcolonies. So here we have the start of the biofilm. Early on, there's a growth rate advantage that is associated with the organisms that, in fact, are not displaying producing EPS. It's actually shown over here, where you have the EPS minus bacteria displaying a faster growth rate. And indeed, you're seeing a fair amount of EPS minus bacteria in these blue individuals. But ultimately, If you're allowing the cells that produce EPS to overgrow, quite literally, the ones that don't produce EPS, then even if there is a growth rate advantage early on, that growth rate advantage can be overcome by what is essentially a shading of the defector organisms by the cooperator organisms. So these are individual microcolonies. These are groups of clonally related cells. They are cooperating with each other in this case by producing this glue that holds them all together and allows them to get bigger with more cells. And it also allows them to gather up more resources, in this case, thrusting themselves out into the current such that, in fact, they're picking up more nutrients. And that gives them a longer term growth yield advantage over the defectors, which are not able to thrust themselves up in the same way. And you can see that in this graph here, where the EPS positive individuals, that graph there, are showing a ultimately yield advantage over the EPS negative ones. And the nutrient that they're picking up is actually oxygen. They're stating that the cells that are thrusting some out, so the cells out further into the current are able to be exposed to higher oxygen densities, simply because closer to the biofilm surface, the cells themselves are utilizing the oxygen and therefore using it up. So there's an oxygen gradient here going from more, which is darker, to less, which is lighter. But it could be any kind of nutrient. It doesn't have to be oxygen. So this is an alternative argument for why biofilms might promote altruism. It's essentially a mechanistic argument. It's the idea that specifically the public good that they're producing, the cooperation that they're effecting, is to produce this extracellular polymeric substance that ultimately provides them with a growth yield advantage. But the production of that EPS gives them a growth rate disadvantage, especially early on during biofilm formation. So these ideas are very compatible with Krefft's ideas that we looked at previously. It's just that they're providing a mechanism. And so this idea of shading is shown here. So what we have is a microcolony that has grown up, thrust itself out into the current, and as a consequence, the microcolonies that are around it are exposed to nutrients to a lesser extent. And this, the idea here is that these larger microcolonies that can produce, they can generate a larger microcolony because they have all this good glue holding them together, the EPS, are shading the other microcolonies, and as a consequence, not only are they able to produce more cells total by being bigger, but they're able to interfere with the production of cells by defectors by essentially shading them. And this is another way of saying that these cooperative microcolonies are better competitors than the defectors are. By displaying restraint, they are able to ultimately to be better competitors within their environment. And this again is very similar to the ideas of K selection versus R selection, where K selected individuals invest in something other than maximizing their reproductive rates in order to be competitive in competitive. Competitive competitors within the environment they're in, and that is an advantage given that the environment is one that's quite mature, such that there aren't a whole lot of niches or space to fill up with your progeny. So your progeny better be very effective, or in the case of yield of these microcolonies, very numerous, so that they can find locations in which they can establish themselves in these otherwise highly competitive environment. And this idea of shading is also shown here, where you essentially have trees. So these aren't oak trees, but let's say they were. The oak tree is shading out its competitors, its immediate competitors. It's a long-lived plant, and there's not a whole lot of that can grow underneath an oak tree because of all the shade the oak tree produces. And so this is providing it with a a competitive advantage in an otherwise very crowded environment where there aren't a whole lot of opportunities for progeny to get established. So once you've become established, so in the case of plants, it's soil location in a sunny spot in the soil that is limiting for them. Once you've become established, one strategy is to remain established in those locations for as long as you possibly can and produce as many seeds of progeny as you can. But that comes at an early growth rate disadvantage. An alternative strategy is to be a weed, to land, grow as fast as possible, make as many seeds as you can in the short term, and then die. So note the shading. And note the shading. Another example of a organism that, in fact, once it's established itself in a location, it stays there for long periods of time. And one of the things it can get out of being in that location and having a sophisticated ability to hold cells together is to thrust itself out into the currents and therefore gather up resources. And this is a sponge, and this sponge is doing just that. So sponges are related to these canoflagellate protists, which essentially look a lot like the feeding cells within these sponges. The canoflagellates can be colonial or not colonial. The larger the colonies are, then the longer they can remain established in one place, the larger they can become, the more gametes that they can produce, and therefore the greater number of essentially disseminating individuals they can produce. And even the more resources they can gather because they're thrusting themselves out into currents, and they're also shading those individuals that are downstream from them. So there's an advantage to, once you've found a location, to sticking with that location. And that advantage presumably comes at a growth rate disadvantage early on, but it ultimately can produce a growth yield advantage as these sponges become quite huge. And here's another example of a quite huge sponge thrusting itself off into a current and therefore picking up lots of resources. Those lots of resources can support lots of germline cells, which give rise to the gametes, which are essentially the disseminating phase or part of the disseminating phase. Zygotes give rise to larvae, which also are involved in this dissemination. But by sticking together, by investing in some structural integrity early on, these sponges can display larger sizes, and therefore ultimately they can produce more babies over long periods of time than if they displayed instead the ultimate of growth rate advantage, which would be finding themselves in attached to some substrate and making a single cell that then goes on to having to find a new substrate. So this is quite the opposite. And when we get to ideas about evolution of greater size and complexity, we'll return very much to these considerations that we've talked about with regard to the evolution of our cooperation among microorganisms, such as you can see in biofilms. So this is, we looked at all this already. This is a cellular slime mold. When the slime molds reach a point where they are in an environment that is no longer highly nutrient rich or it's drying out, they instead gather together and form into these fruiting bodies. And you can see the fruiting bodies, again, are these complex multi-celled structures that are thrusting the organisms out into something, in this case, into air. And what they're gaining in this thrusting of their bodies out into the air, in this case, is a greater potential to disseminate. So they're making spores that drop into the wind and fly away to new locations. And they're doing so more effectively because, in fact, they are relatively large. And to be relatively large, you have to have some means of being cooperative. And we've already discussed that it's potentially difficult to understand how they can get away with being cooperative. But that they're being cooperative, there's no question. And what they are gaining by being cooperative is this larger size and complexity that directly translates into a greater potential to disseminate. So note similarities between these these fruiting bodies and the previous page's mushrooms, that is the microcolonies, as well as, in fact, the sponges that we just looked at. So these are complex structures that improve dissemination, but they require some restraint on some level in order for the them to build. And the big question about cellular slime molds is how it is that you in fact have that restraint, how it is that you have that cooperative restraint. But that's a different question from the idea of once you have the restraint, what are the advantages associated with it? And the advantages, again, are that you have a greater potential to disseminate more cells, which have, therefore, some potential to find new locations where they can establish more of these amoebas and then fruiting bodies, which then can go on to establish more amoebas and fruiting bodies and so on. There's an advantage to displaying restraint. If these guys, as amoebas, just dried up and turned to individual spores, they'd be sitting there on the soil, and their potential to disseminate to distant locations would be much lower. So we've talked about growth rate versus growth yield to a large extent. And let's talk about that more explicitly. So this again is Kreft. So Kreft 2004. So the origin of altruism is a fundamental problem in evolution. So we can just call this cooperation if you like. And the maintenance of biodiversity is a fundamental problem in ecology. The two problems combine with the fundamental microbiological question of whether it is always advantageous for a unicellular organism to grow as fast as possible. The common basis for these three themes is a trade-off between growth rate and growth yield, which in turn is based on irreversible thermodynamic principles. So basically, you can't maximize growth rate and growth yield at the same time. The trade-off creates an evolutionary alternative between two strategies, high growth yield at low growth rates versus high growth rates at low growth yield. So growing faster, but growing more slowly, but having more babies ultimately, versus growing more rapidly, but having fewer babies ultimately. High growth yield at low growth rate is a case of an altruistic strategy because it increases the fitness of the group by using resources economically, which is another term we'll be using a lot, at the cost of decreased fitness or growth rate. So it's more economic, more efficient use of resources, making more progeny per unit of resource utilized. That gives rise to a high growth yield. So it is at the cost of decreased fitness or growth rate of the individual. And this is, we saw in the biofilms early on, and that gave them a growth yield advantage later on as the biofilms or environment matured. The group beneficial behavior is advantageous in the long term, whereas the high growth rate strategy is advantageous in the short term. And as Kreft has already pointed out, as we've read, basically standard microbiological techniques in the laboratory tend to select for those individual organisms that display a high growth rate rather than high growth yield. So there's a lot of microbiology out there that instead likely is taking advantage of maximizing or at least increasing growth yields at the expense of growth rates. And a lot of the unculturable organisms out there may very well be doing just that, living in environments where there's not a lot of resources, and rather than maximizing growth rate, they're maximizing growth yield. And the biofilms as well represent a situation, in fact, where cooperative behavior may be displayed by the bacteria involved because they're, again, maximizing their longer-term growth yield rather than their shorter-term growth rate. And it was a long time before microbiology came to appreciate biofilms. And again, this is likely because there was an emphasis more on those organisms that are maximizing growth rate, particularly in broth cultures, rather than necessarily maximizing growth yield. This is an experiment that serves to illustrate this growth rate versus growth yield idea. And this is actually my own experiment. This was published about 10 years ago. And what we have here is time. I almost do all my experiments with time as the x-axis. great limitation on my technique. But any rate, but actually probably pretty appropriate for a person that cares about ecology and evolution in microorganisms. And over here is plaque forming units. So plaque forming units are either individual phages or instead phage infected bacteria. And what we have is the plating of cultures that contain both, and we're just following the increase in the numbers of the total number of phages, either individual phages or phages that are infecting bacteria. If you have a phage, it's infecting a bacterium. It doesn't matter how many phages are inside that bacterium, you'll still get a single plaque. And so as these infected bacteria lyse and release their phages, you get an increase in the number of phages that are in the environment. You can either allow your release of phages to occur naturally by the normal lysis mechanisms, or instead they can occur artificially, where you're artificially breaking open cells and releasing whatever phages are present. And the artificial release you can see right here. These are the open symbols. And the natural release are the closed symbols. And there's a point where the lines between the open symbols and closed symbols cross. And that's known as well, it defines the eclipse period. It's the end of the eclipse period. The eclipse period is the amount of gearing up time of a phage infection while the phage infection has yet to produce viable phage virions inside of a cell. And then once it's produced its first phage virion, that's the end of the eclipse period, and that's basically defined right in here. And you can see I've got two different strains here. I've got the wild type of phage called RB69, which I think we've seen the genome of already, and a mutant of RB69 that I call STA5. That stands for Serial Transferred Ancestry Mutant Number 5. But of course, STA are also my initials. But at any rate, what I did is in this very simple experiment, a single step growth experiment, is I lyse the cells artificially, and what you see is that the wild type, which are the squares, produces more phage progeny overall than the mutant does. So the wild type has a growth yield advantage, but they both start producing progeny at the same time within the cells. So what's really going on here is that the mutant is lysing these cells earlier, and so that's what's being shown with the closed circles. So the mutant is the sorry, with the closed symbols. So the mutant is the circles. And you can see by the earlier increase, rise as it's called, that the mutant is naturally lysing the cells earlier than the wild type is. There's only a couple of minute difference here. But the difference is enough that the total amount of progeny produced by the mutant, which are these circles here, is somewhat lower, almost tenfold lower. No, I guess not tenfold lower. I guess if I recall correctly, it's about threefold lower. That the wild type produces about three times as many progeny as the mutant does. So the mutant has, well, as we'll see, a growth rate advantage because it's releasing its progeny from its cells, from the cell, infected cells earlier. But it comes at a growth rate disadvantage that, at least in part, is a consequence of the wild type displaying what is known as a larger burst size, producing more phage progeny per cell than the mutant does. Now, the wild type displays a growth yield advantage because it's producing more phage progeny per infection, so it's being more economical, more efficient in its use of infected bacteria towards the production of phage progeny than the mutant is. It's getting more phage progeny produced per cell infected. And by contrast, the mutant displays a growth rate advantage, and this growth rate advantage, which we'll see in a bit, is coming as a consequence of it's releasing its progeny sooner. So the wild type releases its progeny later, so has a longer generation time, but produces more progeny overall. The mutant releases its progeny sooner, so has a shorter generation time, but that comes at the expense of its overall yield. So the cheater is the red one, it's the mutant. And the cooperator is the blue one, it's the wild type.